Hello, I'm Bruce Edwards, and welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. In this program, IMF economist Fabio Natalucci on the latest Global Financial Stability Report that says rising corporate debt is a risk.
So we look at a number of indicators of the U.S. corporate credit cycle, those points being that the corporate credit cycle in the U.S. seems to be at the highest point in recent history.
A key objective of the IMF is to pick up on trends that could potentially compromise economic stability, and the Global Financial Stability Report is designed to help it do just that. Fabio Natalucci heads the team of economists who write the GFSR, as it's known. He says the latest report shows financial stability risks are higher than they were 6 months ago. So this year started with some pretty dramatic swings in the financial markets. What do you believe is behind that volatility?
Right. So the past 6 months have been pretty remarkable. We have seen a very large decline in risk asset prices in the last quarter of 2018 as investors became more concerned about downside risk to the global economy, as well as some anxiety about the pace of monetary policy normalization in the U.S., so how fast the Fed was going to raise interest rate and shrink their balance sheet.
Right.
Now, in the first quarter of 2018, we have seen a reversal of these asset price moves that we have seen at the end of last year. So, for example, in terms of asset prices, of equity prices at the end of March, equity prices globally were up between 7 and 20%. We have seen a decline, compression in credit spreads, decline in sovereign yields. And so the reassessment of monetary policy outlook in a number of countries and supportive measure, including fiscal policy, have clearly changed market sentiment.
Yeah.
And so how to put this together? On net, if you take the last quarter and this quarter together, global financial conditions are a little bit tighter on net. So they're tightened a lot in Q4 and then ease in Q1, so they're slightly tighter on net. Now, what do we care about financial condition? If I can step back for a second, the framework we use for financial stability here at the IMF, try to think about shocks, and we are agnostic. We don't want to forecast shocks.
Right.
How those impact financial conditions, so think of those as the pricing of risk. And in this financial stability report, we look at a number of financial vulnerabilities, so leverage, maturity mismatch, liquidity, FX, interconnectedness, and we look across a number of sectors, so sovereign, household, corporates, banks, insurance companies, and other non-financial institutions. And we do this across 29 systemic countries over time. And so overall, to conclude, our overall assessment is that financial stability risk in the short term have increased somewhat since the last GFSR in October. But there are a number of possible triggers that could result in a sharper tightening of financial condition, expose vulnerability, and raise financial stability risk in the medium term going forward. One is that there's a sharper than expected slowdown of the global economy, and there are, in fact, signs that downside risk have increased. Or an unexpected shift in the outlook for monetary policy to a less dovish stance, especially if investors have taken a too benign view of what major central banks have announced. An intensification of trade tension. We still haven't seen a resolution of trade tension between the U.S. and China. And then finally, political risk.
And so what about all this continuing uncertainty about Brexit? How does that play out in terms of financial stability in the Eurozone?
Right. So we've been, of course, monitoring Brexit events for a long time, very closely. So last time we said that we identified two kind of risks. Like one was short-term transitional risk. So as we transition from where we are now to whatever the new endpoint in terms of the UK-EU relationship will be. So for banks, asset management, insurance company, the idea was that you need to rethink your business model, you need to have new headquarters, so a number of possible operational risk. Those were short-term transitional risks. Then this number of medium-term challenges that there will be a function of what ultimately the deal over the long term will be between the UK and the European Union. Those relate to market liquidity, for example, of market fragmentation. If you have two markets that trade the same instrument both in the continent and in London, or risk management issues, how do you run risk management, as well as data storing, as well as data sharing, both between private sector as well as for the public authorities. Now, that was 6 months ago. So where are we now in terms of 6 months later? Our assessment is that the European Union and The UK authorities have taken a number of risk mitigating measures. Some of them we had in fact suggested in the report. For example, they have activated currency swap arrangements between the ECB and the Bank of England. They put in place time-limited equivalents on the part of the European for UK central counterparties. The UK has provided temporary permission measure. They worked on strengthening the liquidity position of banks, dealer, and insurance companies. Mm. And they also have, importantly, urged market participants to prepare for various possibilities in terms of Brexit outcomes so that the private sector itself would do its homework. Mm. Now, of course, especially if in the event of a no-deal Brexit, some risk remain. And this is where I think the concern, if there is a stalemate in the Brexit process, that could unsettle financial markets, especially because they seem to have been taking so far a quite benign view of financial risk. It could damage investor confidence and ultimately could impact business investment and real activity.
Okay, so sticking with the Eurozone, are sovereign banks in a better position to withstand shocks than they were, say, you know, before the euro crisis 10 years ago?
So the report looks specifically at what we call the euro area sovereign financial sector nexus. So the nexus, the relationship between sovereigns and banks. The reason for that is that because fiscal challenges in Italy have rekindled concern about this nexus between sovereign and financial sector. Now, since the crisis, banks have, in the euro area, they have definitely increased both capital and liquidity. So banks are in a much better position. They're stronger, they have more capital, they have more liquidity. However, banks' holding of sovereign debt has increased in some countries. So, for example, as a share of assets, it's a higher number in some countries, as well as there were concerns about NPLs, so non-performing loans. So there have been done efforts to dispose of NPLs, so we acknowledge that work has been done, but the stock of NPLs in some countries remain relatively high. And so the idea is that, why are we concerned? Because strains in the sovereign space, essentially, could have effect on the financial system through a web of connections. So we identified three specific channels. One we call financial channel. So that would be, for example, mark-to-market losses if financial institution holds sovereign bonds or corporate bonds. The second channel is what we call macro-financial channel. In that case, essentially, the shocks spill over from the sovereign to the banks, ultimately to the household and firms. And so that could, for example, raise, again, non-performing loans. And then a third channel is what we call the bond demand channel. Ultimately, financial institutions are the marginal buyer, sovereign. And so if that demand diminishes, that would result in higher yields. So the big concern, to summarize, is that strain in financial sector that could be linked to problems in the sovereign space could then be passed on to firms and households, and that would have negative implications for the real economy.
Mm. And the report also singles out corporate debt as being one of the big vulnerabilities to the global financial system. What is the concern there?
So we have done quite a bit of work on the corporate debt. Specifically, we looked at the cycle dynamics and risk in corporate sector in advanced economies. So the slowing global economy, market gyration that we have discussed in Q4, have raised concern about resilience of the corporate sector in advanced economies. Now, of course, sentiment has improved, so perhaps some of those concerns have diminished, but it remains an issue of trying to assess where are we in the credit cycle at this point. So we look at a number of indicators of the U.S. corporate credit cycle, and those points being that the corporate credit cycle in the U.S. seems to be at the highest point in recent history. Now, when we say that indicators for U.S. corporate credit cycle are at the highest point, I think we need to be mindful, though, as we compare different points in time, that the market is changing. So the market structure is changing, the technology is changing, so demand and supply themselves are changing. So what's different now at this point in the current cycle from previous cycle? One important difference is that what we call market-based finance has expanded. Mm. And so the role of credit provision by non-bank, so those could be insurance company, pension funds, private equity, other essentially entities that are non-banks. That has increased meaningfully.
And is that a big thing when you compare like the U.S. to Europe?
Yes. So the U.S. is a much more market-based finance center system. And so banks play a much smaller role than they do in Europe. In Europe, the majority of credit provision is intermediated through the banking sector. In the United States, market-based finance, so corporate bonds, equities, they play a much larger role than in Europe. So there's a number of structural change that you need to keep in mind when you assess and compare with the past. Now, on the positive side, what we call the debt service capacity, so the ability of firm to service debt has improved because earnings have been strong and because balance sheet is stronger. Now, on the negative, we've seen the earning growth appear to have peaked. So the projection for growth market analysts forecast for earnings have been declining. And also the level of debt is higher and the creditworthiness of borrower has deteriorated. Now, what are we concerned though here? I think the concern is that if there is a sharp slowdown of the economy or a tightening, sharp tightening of financial conditions, the ability of firm to service debt would be affected and then could in some sense lead to a repricing of credit risk. And ultimately, if it's meaningful enough, a credit crunch could in some sense exacerbate or amplify a possible slowdown. So I think that's ultimately it's our concern.
Mm. And another thing that the report singles out is the concern over non-resident investment in emerging markets. Are non-resident capital flows riskier somehow?
So emerging markets were a bright spot in some sense during the Q4 sell-off. Emerging markets, if you remember, earlier in 2018, they've come under pressure in around April as rates in the United States were going up, were increasing and the dollar was getting stronger. And so then they were also being affected by trade dispute concern. But beyond that, going into the fall and through the sell-off in Q4, in some sense, we were positively surprised. They turned out to be quite resilient in Q4. And in fact, portfolio flows turned positive in 2019. So that's been a good period in some sense for emerging markets, and that's reflected in portfolio flows. Now, one reason for the resilience of portfolio flows is that there's been an increased role of what we call passive investors, so investors that don't manage their portfolios actively but tends to benchmark to indices. And benchmark-driven investors are much more sensitive to what we call global factor. So the concern is that essentially as an investor investing in country in emerging market A, you'll be more focused on these global factors, what's going on with U.S. rates, what's going on with U.S. dollars, what's going on with credit spreads. And so shocks on this external shock that would be traditionally propagated through this external factor could in fact propagate to smaller, medium emerging markets much quicker and to a much larger amplitude than in the past.
I see. So China, if we're talking about emerging markets, China is a big player in terms of investment in emerging markets. And given that the Chinese economy is also facing some vulnerabilities, is China now a growing concern?
So we've spent quite a bit of time on China in a number of past reports. So let me start first acknowledging that the Chinese authorities have taken a number of steps to address financial leverage, shadow banking, and risk in the financial sector. However, progress has been less advanced, for example, in reducing vulnerabilities in the what we call investment vehicles assets. So that's the center, if you want, of the shadow banking. This is where the web of net, the net between the connection between the banking sector and non-banking institutions like trusts, insurance, broker-dealer, these investment funds are at the center, and this is where the implicit guarantee, it works in some sense as a glue of this shadow banking sector. In that part, that's where I think less progress has been made. Also, small and medium banks are still weak. Their capital position still needs to improve. Now, overall, as the authorities themselves recognize, these financial vulnerabilities remain relatively high. And so at this stage, the Chinese authority face, in some sense, a difficult trade-off here between supporting the slowing economy, and they have taken a number of measures to do that, but also continuing to address these financial vulnerabilities and also preventing a further build-up of financial vulnerabilities.
So given the dynamics of the global economy in these past several months, what do you recommend that governments start doing to stay on top of all these potential risks?
Let me first spend one couple of seconds to, again, explain how this growth at risk framework we have. It's a very useful tool because it allows us to monitor, assess, and also is very good at communicating in terms of financial stability risk, particularly the vulnerability chart that we now have. So that, in a sense, is the lenses through which we look at the world, and the lenses allow us to think about policy recommendation. And so regarding policy priorities, we have a number of recommendations in the report. I'll group them into three. One on monetary policy. Monetary policy, the suggestion is that data-dependent and clearly communicated monetary policy remain critical to avoid market overreaction and prevent a further deterioration of credit growth. And also, I want to highlight that central bank independence remain paramount here, both for credibility of policy action as well as for effectiveness of monetary policy. The second one has to do more with how to contain financial vulnerabilities, this slow-moving amplifier of shock. Now, our suggestion is that financial sector policy should tackle vulnerabilities in an environment where rates and volatility are likely to remain low for a while. So it's important to address them now and to avoid a further buildup of these vulnerabilities. In particular, where credit expansion is leading to high debt in a number of sectors of the economy, we talk about corporate debt, for example, we talk about sovereign in some countries, it's important to use broad-based macroprudential tools and also develop tools to mitigate financial stability risk outside of the traditional banking sector, acknowledging that the fortress of the system has had more capital, more liquidity, but risk might have shifted away from banks into the other corner of financial sectors. And then finally, policy to increase resilience in emerging markets. The suggestions here are to reduce external vulnerability as strengthen buffers, use exchange rate as a shock absorber, intervene in FX market if financial market condition becomes disorderly, as long as its reserves are adequate, and finally, use capital flow measures only in crisis or near crisis situation.
Fabio Natalucci is Deputy Director of the IMF's Monetary and Capital Markets Department and oversees the writing of the Global Financial Stability Report. You can read the full report at imf.org. And if you like this podcast, you can subscribe on iTunes or on your favorite podcast app. Just search for IMF Podcasts. You can also follow us on Twitter at IMF_podcast.